scripture reading this morning is from Mark chapter 1, verses 12 and 13. Mark chapter 1, 12 and 13. The Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan, and he was with the wild animals, and the angels were ministering to him.
Morning. The process of sermon preparation and writing is a strange one, but I think it's different for everybody. This morning's sermon is admittedly not the most practical daily life application I've ever preached, though I hope you'll get some value out of it. But it's something I came into while studying another subject. Next Sunday, Lord willing, we're going to start a series of sermons that I think will be some of the most practical I've ever preached. And this is what I was studying on the way to that. And so we'll get there, I promise. Next week, Lord willing, we'll get to some very practical sermons, I think, for Christian living. This sermon is more of a huh sermon, one of those where you are studying something and it made you pause and say, I wonder why that is. That's interesting. And you pull on that thread a little bit and a sermon comes out. So that's kind of what happened. I think it'll be interesting just the same. At least it is to me, and, you know, that's all that matters. So, no. We'll be looking at some scenes in the Bible where great Bible figures wander off into the wilderness. It's something that happens every so often in the Bible. The one that I was interested in is the one that Keith just read for us out of Mark chapter 1, but that won't be the first one to get to, because what's interesting about Jesus and his temptation in the wilderness, captured for us in Mark chapter 1, but also in Luke and in Matthew chapter 4. What's interesting about it is he's not the first person to do something like that in your Bible. And I think by taking a look at what the other characters did, we might get a better understanding of what Jesus is doing, and then hopefully out of that, what we as Christians are supposed to learn from it. So if you'll allow it, this morning we'll take a little excursion into the wilderness. And we're going to begin in Exodus chapter 34. Exodus 34 is a scene that you'll know if you're familiar with the story of Exodus, that they have come out of Egypt and they have meandered down to Sinai. And arriving at Sinai, Moses has gone up the mountain to speak and with the Lord and receive the commandment of the Lord. This is a monumental scene in the history of Israel, where the Ten Commandments are going to, you know, be kind of brought out of this story of the law. They've already been read in a previous chapter. But this is the continuing story of Moses receiving the law at Sinai. And the text begins in verse 28 through 35. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water, and he wrote on the tablets the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, that he came down the mountain, Moses did not know what the skin of his face shone, because he had been talking with God. Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with them, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the people of Israel what he had commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face was shining, and Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with him. So a lot of detail there on a scene that's not immediately obvious as to why we should care. If you're reading that text, it's interesting, it's fascinating, but why should we care that Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights? That's very detailed information. Why should we care about the shining of his face? Why should we care about the kind of repeated interaction there that he goes in and those Aaron and them see him, he veils it, takes the veil off, and he goes back, and he comes back and takes the veil off? Why is that interesting? Why is it valuable information for Israel to know when they read this? Why is it important for us as Christians? I think a couple of things are interesting because this is the first of three distinct 40-day fasts that we read about in our Bible. Today we're going to look at all three of them. Three distinct 40-day fasts of important Bible characters. Fasting is something we'll talk about in a few weeks when I get to my sermons, I promise you. But for right now, just suffice it to say that it's a practice that you find in your Bible that was just an assumed part of the life of Christian people and of ancient Jewish people or Hebrew people. That it was just understood that they would be fasting. If you read the Sermon on the Mount, for example, Jesus says, "And when you fast, do the following." That's in Matthew chapter 6. Nowhere does he give you an if. Isn't that strange? Nowhere does he say, "And if you happen to fast," or "until you stop fasting," because we'll get over that, or whatever. He just says, "And when you fast." It was an assumed part of Jewish life. It was an assumed part of Christian life in the early centuries. So three very important fasts stick out to us in the history of the Scriptures, and one of those is here given to us in the form of Moses. Important not just because he's fasting, and not just because he's fasting for 40 days and 40 nights, but because of where and when and why he's doing it. He's there on Mount Sinai in this pivotal moment when Israel is really coming to know their God in a new and different way. Before, this was simply the God of our fathers. The God we knew as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But now he is the God who also reveals to us his law and his covenant. And they come to know him in a special way. And in order to do that, Moses, on their behalf, goes up the mountain. A mountain in the wilderness. I know the word wilderness isn't there anywhere. But Sinai is a wilderness. Sinai is out in the middle of nowhere. There's one or two locations on the map where they think it might be. None of them near anything. It is the wilderness. They are out there meandering around. They come to Sinai. And he goes up on this mountain and he fasts for 40 days and 40 nights. So a couple of quick observations and then we'll move on to the second of these fasts and start drawing some more observations. The first one is that the fasting prepared Moses for the reception of the law. That fasting was the kind of thing that called your attention to what God was doing that was special and unique. And to get people's attention, Moses goes up the mountain and he fasts for 40 days and 40 nights. The fast also allowed Moses to have nearness to God in an unprecedented way. One of the most remarkable phrases in that particular passage, I want you to hear it again. He was not aware that his face was radiant because he had spoken with the Lord. Ponder that just a moment. In the scene that follows, it tells you what he means by his face was shining. Okay? His face, and some presumably miraculous, inexplicable detail, is literally shining forth light that frightens people. Okay? Aaron and the others that know Moses very well see him after the mountain scene is over, and they are frightened by the appearance of Moses. So much so that he goes ahead and puts a veil over his face to hide it. And it's indicated in the scene that this is a result of his nearness to God. And when he goes near to God, he takes the veil back off. When he leaves God, he puts the veil back on because you couldn't bear to see someone who had been that near to God. You certainly couldn't bear to see God. Well, what's interesting about it to me is not just the shining and not just the veil, it's that Moses himself didn't notice. Now, I'm a pretty oblivious person to my personal appearance. Some of you have noticed. I don't often take as much care as I probably should. But I think if my face were shining like a light bulb, if I am a living, breathing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, I think I might notice. Moses, however, does not. And what I think the text is trying to tell you about Moses, that in this 40-day fast at the top of Sinai, he comes so near to God that he simply stops noticing himself. And this appearance to everyone else is very obvious. Moses, it's not. It's simply what he looks like today. Can I quote C.S. Lewis again because I do it so much anyway and don't ask for permission? Lewis was fond of discussing humility with the following definition. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking of yourself less. And I really believe that's kind of what you're getting to see in Moses. Just not that he doesn't think he's a good person, but a lack of self-awareness. He has been so attentive to God, so close in communion with God, that his face is literally shining with God's glory. And everybody else can tell something is different about Moses. But not Moses. Because Moses wasn't looking at his own face. He was looking at the God of glory. And that's all that mattered. Can I suggest to you this is a great metaphor for what the Christian life should be like? When you behold the God of glory, you begin to shine with His glory. But to do that, you have to think about yourself less. You have to be less concerned with who you are, what you're doing, me, 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 all the time. When you behold the image of God, you start looking like Him when you stop caring what you look like. And that difference is, I think, what we're seeing in the face of Moses. And everybody else sees it. A truly humble person, everybody else notices. Everyone says, what a humble guy that is. But that person doesn't. That person thinks about his pride and things he needs to get out of his life. Moses is literally shining with the glory of God and doesn't even notice. So I think what we're seeing here is this 40-day fast that's being pictured here allows this kind of nearness to God. In this scene, the way it's described, and I'm not advocating a universal fast for everybody. We'll talk about fasting in another sermon sometime. But what I am noticing that this fast, this 40 days and 40 nights alone with God, even neglecting his own physical needs, allowed Moses to think of himself less and prepare himself for the task ahead. And that's the third observation that you see in verses 30 to 35. The fast prepared Moses for his task of leadership. And when you're reading scriptures and you read about fasts, they're often associated with leadership. In the book of Acts, for example, when they get ready to appoint the special servants in Acts chapter 6, the whole congregation, and especially the men who are going to be appointed in that role, they fast. Why? Because they are preparing for leadership. They are attuned to the task ahead of them, and they give it their careful attention. Well, that's what I think we see here. That's the practice of Moses and others. That if you're going to lead, you have to think about yourself less and see God more. And so my summary then of this particular scene, and I know, hang on, we're getting somewhere. 40 days and 40 nights of fasting in the wilderness, up on the mountain, is Moses drawing near to God. Moses thinking less of himself and more of his God. And Moses preparing himself to lead. And God preparing Moses to lead. And the result was tangible. The result was visible. He was visibly different because of it. And didn't even notice. Another scene where we see something very similar is at a different wilderness, well, let me say that differently, at a different time, but the same wilderness. And here I want you to turn to 1 Kings chapter 19. And the story will stretch from verses 4 to 17. This is the story of the prophet Elijah. Elijah is a fascinating character. He is well known in the Old Testament as a troublemaker, and here he is at his troublemaking best. He has provoked Ahab the king. He has provoked Jezebel. He has provoked the prophets of Baal. Pretty much everyone's unhappy with Elijah. And Elijah has determined that his life is about to meet a dreadful end. His life is over. Nobody cares about God but him, and he goes into the wilderness, and he's prepared to die. Prepared simply to meet his end. And he goes into the wilderness, beginning in verse 4. But he went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no longer better than my fathers." And he lay down and slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones, and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. So the scene is Elijah in misery and in a bit of self-pity, if we can criticize him a bit. I think he deserves it there in that scene. A bit of self-pity, though an understandable amount. He thinks he's all alone. He thinks it's time to die. And in fact, he prays to God for death. And an angel appears to him and provides him with food and says to him something I think very interesting. He acknowledges the task The journey is too great for you. A lot of our despair in life comes from the fact that the journey is too great for us. If you attempt to go through life or the various obstacles of life by yourself and without your God, you will find yourself miserable because it's more than you are able to do. You are not made to run on your own steam. You are made to run on God Himself, and there is no fuel apart from Him. The journey is simply too great for you. And so the angel comes to Elijah and he provides him with food. Such food of the like the world has never seen, right? Because he eats this food and he's able to travel for 40 days. Oh, there it is again. 40 days and 40 nights. And where does he go? He goes to a mountain in the wilderness, the Mount of Horeb. Get your Bible dictionary out. Horeb is just another name for Sinai. It even tells you there, it's the Mount of God. So he goes to that same mountain in that same wilderness on the same 40-day fast that Moses had so many years before. And there he comes to know his God. And just like God spoke to Moses, God is going to have something to say to Elijah. For the sake of time, we won't go through all of it. But in verses 9 through following, Elijah repeats his complaint. He says, okay, I'm not really getting any point here. I still want to die. I am still miserable, and I am still all alone. Everyone wants to kill me. Go ahead and take my life. And so God speaks to Elijah. And just like at Mount Sinai so many years ago, the mountain itself begins to rumble, like it had when God came down to give the Ten Commandments. But this time the text says God wasn't in the earthquake. In fact, there's a handful of really dramatic evidences of God's presence. But the text says, that wasn't really God either. He was God, but He wasn't there. What God is in verse 12. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? Fascinating. God appears to Elijah just as He appeared to Moses. Moses had seen God in a burning bush. So there's a fire, but God says, no, that's not it. God had seen, Moses had seen God in a shaking mountain, but God says, no, that's not it. Instead, in a very quiet voice, what are you doing here, Elijah? Give me the goosebumps. I don't know if your parents were like this or not. I was never afraid when Dad was yelling. When Dad whispered. That's when I wanted to crawl under something. Something bad was about to happen. What do you think you're doing here, Benjamin? That was time to be frightened. And that seems to be exactly what happens. The mountain shakes, but that's not him. The fire burns, but that's not him. What are you doing here? And Elijah comes to know the nearness of God. And in this case, it's not very pleasant. Elijah, I'll give him points for bravery in the next verse, repeats his complaint. I was smarter than that. I'm going to take credit. I was smarter than Elijah when I was a young man. And Dad says, what do you think you're doing? I said, nothing. Right? I knew what the right answer was. Elijah just digs in. He says, I'm ready to die. Take my life and let me be. Better that I should be gone. God's not impressed. And God responds to Elijah with a powerful answer, a reminder that Elijah is not alone. That God is with Elijah. God has been with Elijah. God is with other people in Israel. God has been with other people in Israel. And He gives him a task. You're going to go and you're going to appoint kings. You're going to appoint prophets. You're going to appoint priests. You are the prophet of God and He is with you to do His will. And just like Moses, he comes down off the mountain and begins a new task. So we see some of the similarities between these two scenes, same mountain, same fast, same 40 days. And in these scenes, we see that the fast reminded Elijah of what it meant to be sustained by God. Yes, the journey is too great for you, but with God it can be accomplished. The fast allowed nearness to God, which in this case was very frightening, but very real. And finally, the fast prepared Elijah for his own task of leadership. So with these two in our arsenal now, We've seen the 40-day fast of Moses in the wilderness. We've seen the 40-day fast of Elijah in the wilderness. Now I want us to turn to Mark chapter 1, and I want us to start asking some questions. What's the same and what's different? Why is it important for the gospel writers to tell us that Jesus goes into the wilderness and fasts? I think Mark's account, you might find that strange, because it's the shortest account. Beginning in verse 9 and 10 and 11, it gives you a very brief account of the baptism of Jesus. Okay, we talked about that before. And the Spirit comes down like a dove. The Father says, "This is my beloved Son." And remember that phrase. And then in verse 12, it says simply, "The Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness." And he was in the wilderness 40 days being tempted by Satan. And he was with the wild angels. All right, let me try again. There might be wild angels, I don't know. He was with the wild animals, and the angels were ministering to him. What are some things that we see in common, and why might it be important for the gospel writers to tell you about this? Because I think they're making a very direct comparison between great heroes. This is how Moses gave us the law. This is how Elijah returned to his task of prophecy. And this is how Jesus is going to begin his work as well. 40 days in the wilderness, a fast. And I think just like in the case of Elijah, it reminds us of God's sustaining power. Who is it? This is, by the way, a purpose of a fast. I'll get to this in a few weeks, Lord willing, when I talk about fasting and the biblical doctrine of it. But what a fast is designed to do is to call your attention to the fact that it's God that sustains you. And that's what happened at Horeb in the case of Elijah. And that's what happens here. Satan tries it the other way. If you read Matthew's account, Satan says, "Well, if you're hungry, we can fix that. You've got power. I've got rocks. Turn the rocks into bread." And what is Jesus' response? "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." Sustenance comes from God. We live and breathe because of God. We continue in our life and we do whatever we do because of God. And a fast was a reminder of that to anyone who cared to listen. It's also a beginning of his ministry, like it was for Moses. It was a return to ministry for Elijah. And all three of the gospel authors that record this, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all put it at the beginning, which is interesting. Your gospels don't always put events in the same spot. They move them around for teaching purposes. They're not always worried about which happened next. But all three want you to know, Matthew chapter 4, Mark chapter 1, I forget what chapter of Luke, but it's early. All three want you to know this is how things started. You begin in the wilderness. You begin with a fast. You begin with recognition of God. And then we go from there. So I think these things are similar about the fasting of Jesus and of Moses and Elijah. But even more interesting to me are how they are very, very different in some important ways. And let me draw your attention to a couple of them. Look in verses 9 through 11. Again, this is the scene of the baptism of Jesus. In the case of Moses and Elijah, the time of fasting and the time alone in the wilderness was a way to draw near to God. But Jesus doesn't have that problem. Has there ever been a time when Jesus wasn't near to God up to this point? In his heavenly pre-existence, we believe he is with God, John chapter 1 says, and he is God. Why does he need nearness to God? And even in the scene right before this, before the fasting, God from heaven says, "This is my Son, whom I am well pleased." And so for Moses and Elijah, it was an opportunity to draw nearer to God. For Jesus, it's a different task. He's already near to God. He is being driven into the wilderness to do something there that's a little bit different. Who does he find in the wilderness? Moses and Elijah go up the mountain, they go into the wilderness, they fast, and there they are spoken to by God. Jesus meets someone as not God as you can get. There he confronts Satan himself. The fast prepares prepares Jesus for this confrontation of Satan. Instead of going to the wilderness to meet God, Jesus is driven into the wilderness by the Spirit to confront Satan himself. I think when we see this scene, I don't want to overplay my hand, but it is to me Jesus picking a fight. I'm just so impressed by that. It is God saying directly and immediately, you will go out there and you will confront the temptations that are common to man in a meaningful and powerful way. Not to say this is the last time or the first time Jesus had ever been tempted. But why do we call this the temptation of Christ? Because this was set apart. This is a confrontation that stood out. And the fasting wasn't to draw him nearer to God. It was to prepare him for his battle with Satan. I think there's some interesting things we can draw from this. But to make my case, I want to turn to one more passage in Mark. And that's in Mark chapter 9, verses 2 through 8. I don't believe in coincidences in the Bible. And so when I see this in Mark, it stuns me that there must be something of significance to it. In Mark chapter 9, beginning in verse 2, and after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became radiant, intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. ESV there is really close. You couldn't bleach it that white. Very contemporary language. And there appeared to them Elijah and Moses. And they were talking with Jesus. But just pause for a moment. Look at all the strange connections in these scenes. They go up a mountain, like Elijah and Moses. And like Moses, he begins to shine. Again, I love the ESV. You couldn't bleach him that white. He is shining. And he's carrying on this conversation with the two people, precisely the two people in your Old Testament who had been up a mountain, who had been in a fast, and who had had an experience just like that. He goes up the mountain and he meets them there. And so what does Peter conclude? You read the next verse. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter said to Jesus, Rabbi, it is good that we are here. Let us make 3 tents or booths. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. It's tabernacle time. Peter is excited. This is a great place to be. Let's build up a tent to honor all three of these characters. Peter's conclusion is not a bad conclusion. Let's think about it. What he sees is Jesus being honored in the same way as Moses and the prophet Elijah. In the Jewish mind, was there a slot for a human being higher than that? Was there any place a human could ascend in glory and honor than to stand as a comrade of Moses and Elijah? To have a mountaintop wilderness experience. To shine like the sun, like Moses. Peter is thinking right. God has honored Jesus like Moses and Elijah. Peter has just missed one very important point, and to make sure he gets it, just like in the baptism scene, God will speak again. In the baptism scene, notice in all of these scenes, God speaks. He speaks to Moses. He speaks to Elijah. He speaks at the baptism. This is my son. Done well. This is my son. I'm pleased with him. But listen to what he says here. This is my beloved son. Listen to him. And suddenly looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them but Jesus only. So what I see here is the scriptures calling attention to Jesus. And yes, honoring him like Moses, like Elijah. Showing him having an experience very much like Moses and Elijah. A lot of very clear parallels, so much so that they actually show up in the scene we know as the Transfiguration. But what is different? Jesus' trip into the wilderness mirrors his incarnation. Moses goes up the mountain for his benefit. Elijah goes up the mountain for his benefit. Jesus goes up the mountain for our benefit. He didn't go there to draw nearer to God. He was as near to God as he could ever be. Jesus goes there because we need him to. He goes in the wilderness to face temptation for the same reason he goes to the cross. Not because he needs to defeat Satan. I got news for you, folks. God and Satan aren't having a competition on that scale. The old Old Calvinist preachers used to say things like, you know, your soul's like a bone, and God and Satan, they just fight over it, fighting back and forth over you and your life. Do you really think if God and Satan get in a fight, that lasts for more than, you know, as long as it takes to start? When God confronts Satan, it's not for his benefit, it's for ours. When God confronts Satan, it is for us that he does this thing. When Jesus goes to the cross, it's not for his benefit, it's for us. And there's a powerful difference there. Jesus leaves the nearness of God to fight our battles. We go into the wilderness to find our God, but Jesus goes into the wilderness to find us. He is to be honored. Yes, he is to be honored like Moses and Elijah, and yes, he knows God in that intimate way like they did, but so much more. And he has come for this purpose, to rescue us. And so in the scriptures, the God of heaven declares, "Hear ye him." Moses was great. Elijah was fantastic. But it's the voice of the Son of God. Hear that now? On the mountaintop, they all got to hear God. But on the scene of the transfiguration, God says, listen to him. In listening to Jesus Christ, you are listening to God. Times past in divers manners, God spoke to the fathers by the prophets, but hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. Hear the gospel of Jesus Christ and see the authority that God has put in him at the mountaintop and in every other scene in the life of Jesus. Acknowledge it and submit to it in faith and make your life like unto his. Forget a little bit about yourself and see yourself transformed into the likeness of Jesus, which shines with the glory of God. Now, if you stand and sing, if there's anything we can do to help you, won't you come at this time?